This is the one set in 17th century London.
And 21st century London.
And World War I London.
And Roman London.
And the inside of someone's head.
It's called Dead London.
Here we go.
Reviewing audiobooks now too, cause we love our Doctor Who.
In Catherine, we're in Tom Odawar, Dalek, Spacetime, and Glam Rock.
Stylophones are awful, that's a TARDIS way. We're at Spunk and Merryskin.
That's Kane with a K.
Who back when? Reviewing all of who there is. Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Audiobook by audiobook.
Even those that are gobbledygook, we'll review them all, you see. So join us on this odyssey.
It's Who Back When.
Who Back When.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin, and I am joined today by JD.
Hello!
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
And today we're going to be looking at Dead London, aren't we?
Oh, God. Well, it is dead to me anyway. It is forgettable.
I've forgotten it already, which probably won't really be very good for this review.
Okay, we've already alluded to the fact that we didn't like this episode, but why do we not like this episode?
It's got a lot of great ideas, it's got some amazing guest voices, and it is ultimately forgettable, which is probably a bigger crime than it being awful.
Okay, well, once again, I look forward to your guest voice trivia tangents, because I have no idea who's guest voicing here, but I honestly don't care. This was written just as fluff, and I'm now looking forward to spending the next 45 minutes with you on Skype, tearing it to shreds. In that sense, thank you very much, Dead London. We need to do a bite-sized chunk of Who.
I'll sing the bite-sized chunk of Who every week until you get round to actually doing the bite-sized chunk of Who jingle. So what should we have this week? Do you want to know the plot telling the story of the book? This is the bite-sized chunk of what you've missed, the bite-sized chunk of Who. If you need to know the plot, listen in to Who Back When. Subscribe and rate when on iTunes next.
That was awesome. Dude, why isn't that our theme tune? That was fun. Well done. Well done.
It's okay. Wait until you... I've got another one for Max Warp as well. You know, it's one of those things.
Oh,
I was really bored last night.
I was just going to say, man, you are so bored. All right, so, bite the chunk of Who, shall we?
We open on the Doctor appearing before court for a traffic violation, having illegally parked the TARDIS while Lucy was off shopping at Primark.
But then, kerblammo, he is transported to 17th century London, still in court, and is sentenced to death for his crimes.
Meanwhile, Lucy Miller is wandering around yet a third version of London, namely World War I era London, dodging trams and zeppelins.
So something is clearly not right, and while Doc teams up with a faux companion tightrope walker named Sophie, and Lucy tries not to get shivved by a blind serial killer, we're forced to endure the rest of this traumatically bad episode.
Which, thankfully, isn't a two-parter.
Yep. There you go, bite-sized chunk of Who, done and dusted. You're welcome, people.
So, we start the episode, and we start it cold open in court. And, you know, the judge calls the Doctor forward, and basically, he's been charged with leaving the TARDIS on a double yellow line in Holborn.
Yeah, in Holborn. I know. Fantastic. I love it when they drop little bits of London into these stories, by the way.
No, I didn't even realise that was a real place. That shows how little I know geography.
I pass Holborn on the tube every day I go to work. Anyway, so he is in court. We have a little bit of, I guess, banter between him and the judge. The judge is quite a clever person. This is the forgettable nature of this episode. I remember there being banter, but I could not quote it to you at all. Could you?
No, I can't remember a single word that is spoken in this episode, which is quite unusual, because I can still quote Human Resources, and I can quote everything from Max Warp the next episode. But but this one is almost a mystery. It's like when you've watched something on television or when you listen to an audiobook and it's erased from your mind. It's like the flashy thingy from Men in Black. You forget about this episode the moment it's over.
That's true, but you are still... While you forget about the details of this episode, and please, ladies and gentlemen, put this to the test. Listen to this episode, because you're actually not going to lose anything. You're not going to retain any traumatic memories of this episode, so you might as well. you're not going to remember the finer points, but you will still be left with an impression. And the impression I have of the opening scene is there is a bit of banter. Like, they're matching wits, basically. And it seems, just to sort of move the plot along, it seems as though the judge is actually about to set him free. He says, well, it seems to me, Doctor, that the police has acted rashly in this case. And the doctor interrupts him and goes, well, yes, I couldn't agree more. I take it that means that you will now set me free. And then we hear a little wibbly-wobbly noise. There's much more sort of ambient noise, background noise. And it turns out he has somehow been transported back in time. He's now in 17th century London. He's in the Old Bailey. He's still in court. And he's also just about to receive a sentence. And it turns out this sentence is a death sentence.
Considering how bad his parking has been in the previous episodes in season one, that's probably fair. But the nature of the background noise is that it's done while there's a lot of people in the court. You can barely hear it. When he moves from one time period to another, which happens a lot during this story, it's very difficult to know at any one time which time period the people are in.
That's true. And it's very, very common in this episode also. Sorry to cut you off there. It's very common to have a large crowd in the background. Like, there's a lot of murmuring, a lot of people booing and hissing in the background, such as in this court.
And it's very difficult to notice which set of booing and hissing people you're listening to.
Also, just a tiny point. Sorry. I'm cutting you off again. Just a tiny point about the booing and the hissing and the fucking crowds. First F-bomb of this episode, by the way. I am going to absolutely berate the Foley of this episode when we get to our final reviews. Spoiler alert. Because it is so painfully clear, in my opinion anyway, painfully clear that it isn't a crowd. It is one or maybe two people who have been recorded, let's say, 20 times and are being played at the same time. And even though that may have been the case in the past, we haven't noticed that in the past. It's been very well done.
Oddly enough, I was thinking that this is the first out of all of the ones that we've listened to where we've turned around and gone that the background sound effects, the music, the Foley has been poor.
Yeah. But we say poor. I mean, we're not professional by any standards, but I wouldn't be able to produce an audiobook even of this quality, but this does not compare, or you cannot compare it to the previous audiobooks in terms of production value.
No, and the person who did the sound design on this has done other Doctor Who stories.
Okay.
But hasn't done any of the ones that we have listened to so far.
Oh, I see. Okay.
This is the first one he's done. I think it's the only one of the Eighth Doctor Adventures he does.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not bad news.
So, anyway, the Doctor is talking to the judge, and the judge is played by Rupert Van Sittart.
Here we go.
Rupert Van Sittart has a prior Doctor Who connection.
Nice.
He played General Asketh in Aliens of London and World War III. So, you know, and he's one of those actors. So that's our Doctor Who connection of this episode.
Nice. How many voices does he actually do in this episode? Do you know? Does he play... Spoiler alert, people. Actually, who cares? Spoiler alert. Does he play Judge... What's his name?
Ketch
and...
Sepulchre.
Sepulchre, yeah. And... What a weird name. Why would you call a character Sepulchre? This is, again... I'm wibbly-wobbling. I'm oscillating between enjoying and not enjoying the stupid names that they sometimes pick. I'm now back to not enjoying it.
He plays all of them.
Oh, okay. In that case, good on him. Well done, dude.
Oh, yeah. Great actor.
Yeah.
It's just the material is awful. Anyway... We're going to move this along. He's in court and then he's sentenced to death. And fine. The judge says, okay, you know, you're going to Newgate Prison, but the doctor doesn't want to go to prison, which is
fair.
And while this is going on, another prisoner is brought before the judge. This is someone called Spring-Heeled Sophie.
Oh, God.
Now, you say, oh, God, right?
Yeah, I know, and apparently I say it a lot.
But in this case, welcome to the highlight of Dead London, which is Sophia Shepherd.
Yeah.
The tightrope walker of old London town, Spring-Heeled Sophie.
Even though I really dislike some of her soliloquies.
That's fine, but compared to the rest of this episode, she's a highlight, and she is played by Claire Buckfield. And we have already met Claire Brookfield in the Eighth Doctor Adventures.
Wait, hang on, I'm going to guess. Did she play future Mussolini in Human Resources? No.
No, sorry about that one. Okay. She was the better half of the Tomorrow Twins.
Oh, really?
Yes, from Horror of Glamrock. She was Trisha Tomorrow.
Well, she is not lucky in scoring episodes of the Eighth Doctor Adventures.
It is really sad, but she is the highlight of this episode.
She is, yeah.
So she's being charged with something or other, and I can't remember what she's being charged with.
Well, she is a funambulist. She is a tightrope walker who has started, for personal gain, to use her skills as a tightrope walker to commit theft. She was arrested, and on her person was found a silver etui, I want to say, of great value. And they say, like, oh, it was worth a whole £10. And then we get lots of oohing and aahing from the crowd.
Long story short, she's also sent to prison.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, because honestly, right?
We
can't get drawn into this episode. Because
no, that's true.
We'll just make ourselves miserable.
That is true. I've got a question for you, though, because I'm not entirely sure, but I think maybe we did miss a point that the doctor recognizes the judge. He asked, I can't remember what his name was. He said, like, oh, I don't.
Jeffries.
I was going to say, yeah, Judge Reinhold. Now, like, okay, so he says, wait, hang on. Are you Judge Jeffries, the hanging judge? And he says, yes, I am. And it turns out that the doctor is actually a personal acquaintance, like an actual, well, quote-unquote friend of Judge Jeffries. He's at least met him at some point. And it starts asking the judge questions about his own life, like your wife's name, how many children do you have? And it turns out the judge has no idea about any of this, so he is very clearly an imposter.
Yeah, and, you know, Judge Jeffries is a real person. He was actually a Welsh judge, so... frankly, he doesn't even sound like he's Judge Jeffries. Why was he in London? He was the Lord Chancellor of James II.
Oh, really?
Yes.
There you go. Who back then? Aiming to educate. Thank you very much for that.
And it was a non-Doctor Who tangent.
I know. That's a first.
Meanwhile,
yes, here, just move this along. God, I want to get to Max Warp.
In World War I London, Lucy Miller has gone to Primark. She's bought a few clothes and she's come out and there's a power cut.
Yeah.
So it's all dark, it's all blacked out, which because it's World War I London. And Lucy is narrowly avoids getting hit by a tram, which is obviously not real London these days. And she starts interacting with this woman called Yellow Beryl.
Yeah, great name.
Who is one of the munitions workers who basically builds ammunition for the war effort.
Yeah, she stuffs TNT into shells. She's called Yellow Beryl because, I didn't know this either, but we learned from this episode that the munitions workers, in dealing with TNT, their skin actually turned a shade of yellow. Didn't know that.
You know, and like the rest of the guest cast in this episode, she does a good job of her voice, but she would do.
Because?
She is played by our old friend, Katriana Olsen.
No way!
The Headhunter.
That's fantastic.
Who seems to be contractually obliged to be in every episode.
Yeah.
but you know, once more, Katriana Olsen comes to save the day, and she tells Lucy Miller that it's 1917, and they run off to try and get away from the trams and the...
And Zeppelins.
Zeppelin
approaches in the sky, and you can hear bombs in the background. House close by is blown to smithereens, so they take off towards the post office near St. Paul's or something. Or maybe it was St. Well, fuck it, who cares? It was somewhere around that area, and because there's a shelter there.
Yeah, they need to get away. They need to go into the underground because not only were Zeppelins, but there's a serial killer.
Yeah, the blackout killer.
Who goes around and all, you know, you can hear before you die is the tap, tap, tapping of his stick upon the ground.
Oh, spare me.
Thankfully, we are spurred by going back to the Old Bailey. So Sophie and and the Doctor start basically talking to each other.
Yeah, and it turns out another object that she has purloined is a snake box. A tiny little box that has images of snakes thereupon, and it was an object that would normally be found in the old, what was it, the Temple of...
Dionysus.
Dionysus, yes. And one would keep snakes therein. But in this case, sorry if I'm speeding through this, by the way, or actually, you're welcome, I'm speeding through this a little bit. In this case, it is not filled with snakes. Instead, it is filled with lots of blinking lights. And Sophie has been pressing these lights. She's been touching them. The Doctor identifies these lights as buttons, as circuitry, and also identifies the box as being made out of a metal called Talmodium, which is a metal only found on Quadric, some planet, who cares where.
And apparently it's got reptiles living there, and the box in Roman times was called the Sister Mystica.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the Doctor says, right, well, the buttons were what brought me here. Someone has been manipulating space-time wibbly-wobbly. The enemy, the person who should have been controlling these time-space anomalies, is in fact stuck because they don't have a control box.
Exactly, because if you are a major bad guy and you have an object like this, or you need an object like this, you would only have one of them, right? I mean, that stands to reason, I think.
Meanwhile, because, you know, let's just move on.
Before we move on, why does the Doctor not ask her where she stole it right away? Because that is actually of importance to the plot, and he will eventually ask her, or rather she'll volunteer the information independently, but if he had asked her now, he could start piecing everything together right away.
Yes, because there is this great TV trope called having the idiot ball, which is required for most of the people in this episode, because otherwise you and I would be sipping our coffee and cigarettes and not have to listen to the rest of this episode.
Anyway.
Meanwhile,
yeah,
back in 1917,
yeah,
Lucy is heading off to go and see the Doctor, and yeah, you know, she says goodbye to Beryl, and fine, everything goes away.
Yeah, she doesn't get far though, because blammo, a river turns up out of nowhere and just blocks her way, basically. And she's now still with Beryl and goes like, wait, what the hell? Like, there's a river. And it seems as though Beryl is completely cool with it.
And frankly, considering some of the things Lucy has seen in previous episodes, she should be completely fine with it.
That's true, so, but we do get a little bit sort of an ominous vibe here from Beryl, who says, yeah, that river turns up sometimes, sometimes it isn't there, sometimes it is there. Lucy goes, what's on the other side? And she says, well, you know, usually it's Fleet Street, but it depends on what he wants. So obviously, Beryl is aware of someone controlling matters, but basically, what we learn from this is that if you start to question things, you are going to go totally ape nuts. And as a consequence, Beryl does not want to discuss this topic any further.
That's also true. And, you know, Beryl mentions that the river moves around. She mentions about other people from other time zones. Lucy's quite surprised that Beryl, you know, knows about time travelers. But then Beryl makes a perfectly clear point that with what Lucy's wearing, she couldn't come from 1917, which is fair. Boob tube and short skirt. And, you know, Lucy says she's going to find a way across the river. And
yeah, so they split
and,
up.
And they split up. And goodbye, Beryl.
Yeah.
Anyway, back in the Old Bailey,
yeah,
the Doctor and Sophie have a conversation. They talk about finding the box and where it came from, and she says she stole it from a Roman temple.
Yeah. Now we find out about the Roman temple, but again, as you said, idiot ball, they leave it at that. Essentially, it's just like, okay, so something shifty is going on in this Roman temple. And also, wait, there's a Roman temple? But let's just leave it at that.
So they mention that, well, Roman Britain and 17th century London seem to be right next to each other. Sophie doesn't seem to be worried about this. And then the clerk of the court is heard, you know, doing basically public service announcements outside. And the Doctor says, ah, I seem to have heard his voice somewhere before.
Yes, but we don't find out more about that. We cut back to Lucy, who is now walking along the river on her own, And what do we hear behind her if not the tapping?
Tap.
Of a stick. And that's it. That's it. We cut
that,
back.
That was the entire cutscene. Anyway, yeah. Meanwhile, back at Newgate, or back at the Old Bailey, rather.
Yeah, a turnkey is arriving with Sophie and Doc SD, delivering them to Mr. Ketch,
who is basically going to go and take them and hang them at Tyburn Tree.
Exactly. But Doc recognizes Mr. Ketch as something other than a human. He starts saying, well, aren't you the same person as the judge? Aren't you the same person as blah, blah, blah? Are you not, in fact, the guy behind all of this?
Aren't you from Quaggrig?
Yeah.
A reptile.
Yeah. But we still don't get much more of that. Ketch just starts getting really threatening. He's like, well, you know what? Sometimes I don't do a great job of hanging people. Sometimes it takes a long time for them to die. And that's it. Cut back to Lucy.
Thank God. And she arrives at a pub.
Yeah.
And
the pub is on the other side of the river.
Yeah. And she basically notices that people are standing outside smoking. Therefore, it must be after the smoking ban.
Yep.
And so she's not in 1917 anymore. She still can't get across the river.
And the people at the pub are just drunkards. They're completely tipsy and cannot help her very much. But it doesn't really matter because we're going to hear the tapping again. All of a sudden, whammo, there's the killer. And he introduces himself. In fact, introduces himself as the Blackout Killer. Really? Anyway.
Meanwhile, on the way to Tyburn Tree, the Doctor and the Hangman have a conversation. Offers to basically kill the Doctor quickly for a bribe. I tried to ask him if he'd kill me quickly and get me out of doing the rest of this episode, but sadly he didn't respond.
Anyway, the Doctor starts speaking to him in Quaggrig, or how would you pronounce that? And Mr. Ketch finally de-scoobifies himself and reveals that he is a snake person. It says that he is known, or they are known, as the Sepulchre.
Back with Lucy. She's running through the streets, and eventually the Blackout Killer finds them.
Yeah, she runs into like a cul-de-sac or something.
Because he is totally Matt Murdock daredeviling her.
Yeah.
Because he can hear everything. He's got a stick, he's blind, and, you know, he's totally sonaring her.
Yeah, he is.
Then he transmogrifies himself into an alien and tries to kill her.
Yeah, and that's pretty much it as well for that cutscene. All he says as Mr. Snakeface is that they need new blood. We're saying we did actually skip something. The doc revealed that the Quaggrig, they have a hive mind, I guess sort of a collective. So all these little characters that we've met, they are avatars for the one creature called Sepulchre. He is guiding all of them and aware of what all of those avatars are doing. They're going to, in a way, argue against that one fact later on in the story as well.
Meanwhile.
Okay.
Honestly, this is just an entire section of meanwhiles, because there's no linking narration between what's happening to Lucy and what's happening to the Doctor. There is very little linking between the stories at all. Mm. And it's just narratively really hard to hold together.
It is, yeah.
With the Doctor. And Sophie.
Yeah.
They're arriving at Tyburn Tree, which is in London, and that's where basically everyone used to get
this hung. Is the only part of the entire story where the Foley is actually, not the Foley, but the sound editing is actually well done. Because the Sepulchre version of Mr. Ketch is talking to them about how they need to kill people to, well, as sustenance, and the death of a Time Lord would be a massive bonus for them. And then, wibbly wobbly, as he is speaking, it is slowly but surely going back to normal, so that as they arrive at the gallows, he is now speaking as Mr. Ketch instead. That's the only nicely done part in terms of sound editing.
And the only nicely done part of the episode's sort of plot is the Doctor now does one of his good speeches. Paul McGann actually does this one very well.
Yeah.
he basically, they notice that when the Doctor is doing things which doesn't fit in this reality, reality starts breaking down, that the laws of the land start coming apart. So the Doctor goes into this speech about how he's always getting in trouble, he's always parking in the wrong places, you know, how he wants to spank Lucy and how he wants, you know, it's all of it.
I bet he does. And then he also gets Sophie to join in, and as she does, everything starts getting a little bit blurry.
Kablamo, they're free.
Good choice of words. Cut to Lucy, who has at this point kicked the blind killer into the river, run along the river. I think we forgot about that earlier on. Who cares? She's now found a bridge, and it leads her to a different time, namely the self-same time that the Doc and Sophie are at.
Thank God, because otherwise it would prolong the episode.
Yeah, and now we know that they are bound to be reunited. In fact, we know exactly how they're going to be reunited. So, speaking
exposition
of the Doc...
Exposition time.
Yeah, speaking of the Doc, he and Sophie are now also by the river, and they're going to take a boat to the Temple of Sepulchre, because this is how long. We are now, what, two-thirds of the way... Yeah, this is absolutely the shortest episode of Who Back When so far. We are now two-thirds of the way through this story, this episode, and it is not until now that we find out where the temple is, how you get there, why you should get there.
What we hear now is the following. The river connects all the time zones. The Sister Mystica comes from the temple. The temple is probably where Sepulchre is controlling everything from. The Doctor and Sophie want to get to the temple in order to use the Sister Mystica in order to set everything right and send everything back to all of their time zones. And the Doctor can then put an end to Sepulchre, stab him in the heart, and get away with the end of this atrocious episode.
And all of that is in one very brief dialogue. Like, it is just condensed exposition. It's fantastically poorly crafted, dialogue-wise, just so intense. They might as well have Daleks narrating the story.
And then Lucy Miller turns up.
Well, we hear a noise, or rather Sophie hears a noise, and gets her quote-unquote mechanics out, i.e. her rope, because somehow she still has all of this gear on her.
Plot hole.
Oh my god, there are so many plot holes. Why did she still have the box? Why did everything? Like, why would the guy... Why would Mr... what's his name again? Kemp? Clench? Clink? Hank? Why would Hank... why would Hank ask the Doctor for a bribe? Like, surely they would just have emptied his pockets before throwing him into the prison. For all they know, he's carrying a knife and a pistol and all kinds of stuff that he could use to escape.
Please ignore the plot holes and move on to the next scene.
All right, so they hear Lucy. She gets her gear out and she lassoes Lucy. So now they are reunited. People are approaching, though, so they jump into a boat and head downriver.
And then the Doctor goes into exposition two, where he explains that there was a lot of lost rivers of London and Fleet, which I imagine something to do with Fleet Street.
I thought so as well. I'm not sure what the history of that is.
And anyone that fell in the Fleet usually died, and it was a dark and dank river. And then the Doctor also adds this time that it's like an information superhighway.
Yeah, well, it's like a neural pathway, he says.
Yeah, it's strange that the time zones he's picked, because we only see, I think, four of them. We see Roman, we see 1917, we see 17th century in 2008.
Yeah, and we hear contemporary as well, the pub.
Which is, 2008.
Oh, right, sorry.
But the problem here is, A, 2008 isn't really that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
B, there was quite a lot of things that happened between Roman times and the 17th century.
And also, the Sepulchre supposedly feeds off terrorizing people, as in just placing people within a historical context of fear and terror and pain and death. So why would they create a pub, a riverside pub from 2008? It really wasn't that bad in 2008.
No, and surely the best time rather than 2008 would have been the Blitz.
Yeah.
That would have been absolutely perfect for all of this.
Yeah, but the Blitz would have been too close in terms of audiobook production. It would have been too close to a Zeppelin blowing stuff up during World War One.
That's true, but I would have thought if they'd have had a choice, they would have gone for the Blitz, which would have been actually a much more terrifying time to be in London.
Yeah, they should have used it. If they were going for World War One, and they want to plonk a freaking Zeppelin above London. That's great, by the way. That's a fantastically nice idea. But then use that. Go with that idea. Just run with it. But they didn't.
No, let's do an entire episode of that, because frankly, at the moment, the Doctor, Lucy and Sophie are still on the river.
Yeah, by the way, Lucy, Sophie and the Doctor, aka LSD.
And trust me, if you're taking any LSD, now don't do drugs, I'm okay, it will make this episode better.
Anyway, yeah.
Anyway, Lucy and Sophie are bonding over clothing at this point.
Yeah.
And we find out that Sophie really likes heroes, pirates, sort of superheroes, and Knights of the Round Table. You know, she's
basically the nicest thief in the world, because the question is, what did she do with the money that she stole? Oh, she bought books for it, chat books, and some kind of pastry, I think it was.
Yeah, and clothing.
And clothing, yeah, sorry.
Sophie's always dreamed of being a hero in one of the books.
Yeah. I wonder if that's going to factor in some way. What do you reckon? I mean, do you think maybe that'll be brought up again at some point? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I hope so, on the grounds that, you know, I'd happily have Sophie on board the TARDIS.
Yeah, me
so,
too. Oh, she'd be a great companion. But hang on, dude, there's one cutscene that we've skipped that is actually of importance, because it is another plot hole. And that is, while LSD are traveling along the fleet, we get a cutscene of the Judge and Hank, Ketch, that's the guy, chatting, despite being from different times. And Ketch actually goes, or maybe it's Turnkey, who cares? It's two different characters from two different times. One of them is the Judge. And the non-Judge version, Hank, let's call him, goes, wait, why are you here? Like, you're not supposed to be here. But they are a hive consciousness, n'est-ce pas? Would they not realize everything? Why do the avatars even need to communicate with each other? Surely they're all just aware of the same thing.
Oh, I've given up caring at this point.
Wait, sorry. The culmination of that cutscene is they now realize that LSD are heading towards the temple, and then we cut back to them traveling to the temple along the fleet. That was it.
And then we get the next cutscene, which is Jack Ketch talking to the voice-modulated Sepulchre.
Oh, yeah.
And basically saying that the Sister Mystica is gone. How did they not notice that the Sister Mystica was gone? And then Sepulchre goes all crazy about it, because the Doctor can use it to kill Sepulchre if they get the box back to the Roman temple.
Yeah, but they need... Yeah, sorry, go for it.
Then Sepulchre starts diverting the Doctor, Lucy, and Sophie down the river to
somewhere else. Yeah, he opens these lock gates that just, I guess, turn the fleet around. So now the water is running the other way, and they're now rushing all the way towards a waterfall. So if this was essentially a weapon at Sepulchre's disposal, why did he not just flick the switch right away?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, go for it.
But then, anyway, they go over the waterfall.
Yep. And they survive.
Because they wake up inside a Wicker Man.
Oh, the bees! Oh my god, the bees!
But Lucy, having seen the Wicker Man, no, it doesn't end up well for Edward Woodward.
Yeah.
And... The Doctor says that Sophie can get them all out because she's a good funambulist.
Yeah, but she's having a bit of a crisis of faith. And then Lucy notices that the Arch-Druid is approaching with a torch. This is Roman London, Roman-era London, maybe one should say. And they are about to be set ablaze. He lights the wood around the feet of the Wicker Man. And then we fade to the temple again, where Sepulchre and two of his avatars, who should not be having a conversation because they are one person, are having a conversation in which they tell essentially themselves that they would very much like to witness the death of the Doctor in person. So, kablamo, they are now going to whizzy-bang over to, to the Wicker Man.
So, anyway, they're on fire now.
Yeah.
And,
Lucy has an idea.
Because Sophie throws the rope, and they then zipline down. Oh, that's the plan anyway.
Dude, what does the Doctor shout when he ziplines across?
Geronimo!
Nice.
But, right.
Tenant vibes, man.
It's my turn to do a Doctor Who plot hole.
Oh, nice! Oh, I'm looking forward to this. Oh.
We are told in The Day of the Doctor, and in fact a few episodes prior to that, that the sonic screwdriver doesn't actually work on wood.
Yes, you're right. Oh my god, you're right. And here he is using, before they zipline across, he uses his sonic screwdriver to
weaken the atomic structure of the wood.
There you go, yeah.
Huh. Which we know can't happen. So anyway, that's a plot hole for you. So anyway, they zipline. they zipline down, and they arrive inside the chamber of Sepulchre.
Oh really? I don't know. You're probably right. I think I'm just zoned out here. Either way, Sepulchre is there.
Yeah, we get exposition 4 now.
And we get a good line.
Oh, go on.
Shall we soundbite that?
Well, we're not going to be soundbiting anything else during this episode, so soundbite?
Soundbite.
It's hideous. Of man, of snake, of ugh.
There you go. Even though I have to say I really wanted to soundbite a That's What She Said from before.
Which one?
If your nose is a better role, go to it.
Anyway, Sepulchre now turns onto exposition and explains that they're inside his reenactment chamber. The Doctor says, well, yeah, the rivers are all by neural pathways and they're all inside Sepulchre's brain.
Yeah, this is actually a gorgeous piece of technobabble from the Doc. He says, and I quote, those invisible tractor beams are dimensionally transcendental.
And basically it means that Sepulchre's bigger on the inside than he is on the outside.
Yeah.
So we get the generic end of episode, give us the box or you're all going to die. And I can't remember what happens then.
Since he is holding onto the box can actually be used to invert the, what should we call it? The TARDIS effect of his mind being bigger on the inside than on the outside. So he could actually invert that, which would kill him. And the girls at this point are pretty cool about that. They're like, yeah, so that'd be fine, right? And the Doctor adds, yes, but it would also kill everyone else who's trapped inside the mind. So obviously he can't do that. However, what he can do is he can sonic the neural pathways to prevent the different avatars from being able to communicate with each other, which again, they shouldn't have to, but that's fine. And that's pretty much it. He does so. Sepulchre is mega weakened and is carried away by the people, because now everyone can see that he's de-scoobified.
Sophie, the Doc, and Lucy have this end-of-episode conversation, and she's decided that I'm going to write a book called The Adventures of Springheel Sophie, and, you know, the very first chapter will be about the Doc and Lucy.
Yeah, nicely fine. Bookended.
Fine. Nicely bookended.
But that is also not the end of the episode, because we need to just ham-fist a little bit more fluff into this audiobook before we can set our audience free. There is. Part one, we get a terrible soliloquy from Sophie. In my opinion, all of her soliloquies are terrible. She's a great actress, but unfortunately they are way too uber-dramatic, and she starts spouting lines like, the rooftops is my domain, I'm the cap of all London town. I can't do the accent, whatever. But terrible. And then we get an end scene with Doc and Lucy. It's some shit pun about, what was it? Oh, he says he's very glad to see Lucy or whatever, or she did a great job. She looks up and says, oh, I was looking for a blue moon up there. And then we get some of the worst fake laughter from the Doctor, because Paul McGann clearly is only contractually obliged to do this audiobook, and not even he is finding a modicum of entertainment in this story.
I walked into that one.
Sorry, Paul, if you're listening to this, by the way, we love you as the Doctor. But
we are so sorry you have to do this episode.
We really are, because I looked around, by the way, for other reviews of this episode, did not find a single positive one.
Well, thank God the episode's over.
Yeah, they go back to the TARDIS, it's covered in parking tickets, and explain to me what happens. They listen to the radio.
No, they listen to the sounds of Sepulchre and everyone that's inside his head.
Oh, right, and now there's revolution across the world, and in this transmission, or sorry, not in this transmission, in what they hear, there are people talking of revolution in Russia and in other parts of the world, so there should be more than just London within his mind. There are other cities in his brain.
I don't care. Anymore. I really don't.
Okay, fair.
You know, at this point, I was just glad that the end credits were coming up.
Yeah, and then they dematerialize, and that's it.
Do you want to do the review first?
Yeah, hang on. Wait, I haven't actually decided what to give this story. So, as I said, I actually had a look around for other reviews of this audiobook, because I didn't want to seem too harsh. The best review that I could find, I don't remember where I read this, but the best review I read was, it said that it was mediocre, that it was sort of this one story that is of no importance, and that's fine. It's a gentle, harmless introduction to season two. And I'm going to say that is true. It is harmless. And even though we have been just spewing vitriol all over it for the past hour or so, it's not a miserable way to spend 44 minutes of your life. So in that sense, it's okay. The Doctor is fantastic. Paul McGann is great. We've already talked about the gallows humor scene. He is amazing in that scene. Sophie, what an amazing companion, even though it's just a companion du jour. She is great. Love her. And Lucy is Lucy. You know, she does a great job. It's a shame that we don't get to see more of her, though. The guy who played Sepulchre, already forgotten his name. Well done, but I cannot take him seriously. I can't take anything that any of the bad guys do seriously. And as such, I'm going to have to say, don't necessarily listen to this one. Enjoy our vitriol instead, and look forward to the next one, because the next one is amazeballs. You may think that I'm giving this too high a mark. I'm giving this a 2.8, because it is harmless. I'm giving it bonus points for good acting. I'm giving it bonus points for great ideas. I'm giving it minus points for not doing anything with those ideas, though. Also, spoiler alert, you haven't heard this yet, but I gave The Chase 2.8 as well. So, comparable in a way.
Okay, right. We disagree on this one. This is the love and monsters of audiobooks. I don't do the television reviews. There is a episode for David Tennant called Love and Monsters.
Okay,
which is such a train wreck, which is only saved by the acting ability of the people in it.
Okay,
this is a complete and total mess of an episode. You don't know what time period people are in. The guest cast are very good, but then they're given awful material to work with. Sophie, Claire Buckfield, redeeming herself. Well, she was good in Horror of Glam Rock, but she does amazingly as Sophie. I would have loved her as a companion. You get a resolution to this episode halfway through, and then it's just a chase through London to get to the end point. I've heard better, and I've seen better. Because this is basically a remake of the last ever Troughton story, The War Games, where they have people from different time zones in next to each other wars, and the war chief and the warlord at the time in this episode are basically pitting them against each other. As it happens, it's to create the best fighters, to create an army, but the story is incredibly similar. So I'm marking this as an episode which is very like the War Games. I'm marking this down for being nowhere near as good as the War Games. And I'm marking it down for the sheer volume of plot holes that go on and on and on and on to the point where you just want the episode to hurry up and end, and it's 0.8.
Wow! Oh my god, that is amazing! 0.8.
It is worse than Phobos and Horror of Glamrock, for me.
Oh, I don't think it's worse than Phobos.
We'll disagree on this one. Yeah. To be fair, we have done... This is the 7th audiobook review, and it's so far the only one we actually disagree on.
Yeah.
So we needed to disagree at some point, otherwise someone's thinking I'd copy and pasting your scores.
No, that is true, and that is good. Yeah, I'm happy that we are disagreeing about this. I should say, I don't know about you, but I'm reaching a point where I'm starting to think about what I've given other episodes, both TV episodes and audiobook episodes.
Yeah.
If this were a standalone thing, I'd probably give it something like maybe 1.3 or whatever. But I've given other episodes that are not great higher scores. Like, for some reason in my brain, I have to put this in relation to that. So if I give The Chase 2.8, I can't give this 1.3 because it is not that much worse than The Chase. The Chase was fucking awful. So, yeah, there you go. That's my disclaimer.
And that was our review of Dead London.
Yes, it was.
People, you have to follow this man on Twitter. He is at Ponkin. That's Ponkin with a P. You can follow me if you want to at Marius Kane.
That's Kane with a K.
Subscribe and rate on iTunes. You don't have to rate us as a 5-star. You can rate us as whatever you wish.
Yeah.
You can go to Reddit, that's /whobackwhen. Follow us on Google Plus, if you use Google Plus, because not many people do.
Which no one does. And please do like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word.
Until next time, I've been JD, and this has been Who Back When.
And I've been Ponken, and Shamalama Ding Dong. Catch you in The Time Meddler. Rock on. Cha-chow.
Who Back When.